Welcome. You are listening to the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Seminar Series. I'm the Center's Director, Ann Stevens. This series brings scholars and policy experts from around the country to discuss their work on poverty and poverty research. In November 2012, we hosted Sheldon Danziger, who is Director of the National Poverty Center at the University of Michigan, where he is also a distinguished professor of public policy. His research focuses on trends in poverty and inequality and the impacts government, social programs, and economic and demographic changes have on disadvantaged groups. Here is Danziger presenting his seminar, Poverty and Anti-Poverty Policy After the Great Recession.
I'm going to, I know Peter Lindert is here, so I'm not an economic historian like Peter, but I'm going to spend a little time talking about recent economic history. Then talk about some early findings from the Michigan Recession and Recovery Study that we're doing at the National Poverty Center. Talk a little bit about how one might reduce poverty and promote opportunity in the next decade, but my bottom line is actually a very pessimistic one. I gave a talk like this in June of 2009, and I was quite optimistic at the time, and I said it was the best of times and it was the worst of times, and I said it was the worst of times because unemployment was about 10%, and I said it was the best of times because the 2009 stimulus, which had passed in February of 2009, had in it all of the aspects that poverty researchers had been talking about for the previous 15 years, a number of specific policy changes, and I'll talk more about them, to unemployment insurance, the Earned Income Tax Credit, Head Start, Pell Grants, etc. And that, you know, the Obama administration was planning to make these things permanent, and that, of course, by 2012, the unemployment rate would be back to 6%, and these policies that were in the stimulus would be permanent, and then we might expect poverty to fall below the levels that we had seen since 1973. We never got below 1973. We got close in 2000, and so I was optimistic then. Now, we're obviously better informed than I was in 2009. The unemployment rate is still 8%. All of these aspects of the stimulus, most of them have expired or will expire, and we're waiting to see how big the cuts are going to be in the programs that I thought would be extended. So I actually think there is no possibility that poverty and inequality are going to decline significantly in the foreseeable future. So, from optimism to pessimism. A lot of people know this, but I know at least a lot of people in economics know this. Hillary and Ann and Marianne have written a lot about this themselves. For a broad audience, I'll go quickly through. And the reason I want to do that is because the post-war on poverty decade really was a golden age of social policy, coming at the end of a quarter century golden age of economic growth. The war on poverty has a very negative perception. Marianne was telling me, I hadn't seen it, that the Wall Street Journal recently had a piece by Gary Becker and Jim Heckman saying the war on poverty failed. Martha Bailey and I have a volume which is under review called The Legacies of the War on Poverty, and we actually think lots of war on poverty programs made remarkable changes, and that poverty would be a lot higher than the high rate today if these programs hadn't been put in place in this decade. But what's in historical retrospect from the current perspective, I guess the soundbite I would say is, as somebody who had a very different view of Richard Nixon in 1974 than I have today, Richard Nixon's social policy was much more liberal than Bill Clinton's social policy, and so in retrospect, the good old days carried through the Nixon presidency. So this post-war on poverty decade really goes from Johnson's declaration of war on poverty in 1964 through Nixon's departure from the White House in August of 1974. And in fact, the reason I remember this so specifically is I started as a postdoc at the Institute for Research on Poverty in September of 74, and every fall is when the poverty numbers are announced. And so the low point is the poverty rate of 1973, which was announced in fall of 74, but is Nixon's last year in office. So this is this remarkable period in which there both is this rising tide that does lift all boats from the period from 47 to 73. There were modest recessions, rapid wage growth for all workers, and I have a little data I'll show after this. The spread of employer-provided health insurance and pensions in this quarter century. Congress is raising the minimum wage relative to inflation. In current dollars, the minimum wage was something like $9.50 in 1973. It's $7.25 today, so the minimum wage has been lower and the poverty rate has been higher for almost every year since 1973, a period of rapidly falling poverty and slowly falling income inequality. And again, people know this. Since then, poverty, which was about 11% in 1973, hit 15% in the early 80s recession, in the early 90s recession, and in this recession. Poverty was falling during recoveries, but never back to the 73 levels. Less educated workers no longer benefit from economic growth. Inequality increases rapidly, and we have an effective safety net only for the elderly, for whom poverty is substantially lower than in 1973, and who, because they have inflation-protected Social Security and SSI and universal health insurance, with Medicare and Medicaid for them, they don't suffer during business cycles the way others do. This is just simple descriptive data which captures this notion of a rising tide lifting all boats on the left. Basically, everybody's real family inflation-adjusted income doubled between 47 and 75. Peter Gottschalk and I, in our book America Unequal, do some fancier computations on this, but simple charts are enough. If anything, the 95th percentile is slightly lower than the other percentiles, but basically a rising tide means all boats, lifts all boats. The bars on the left basically are all around 90%, 90 to 95%, and there, so the level of growth is high and it's evenly distributed. 75 to 2010, a nice little step ladder with those at the bottom gaining relatively little, those at the top gaining relatively little relative to the growth in this golden age that ended in 73, but nonetheless rising inequality. So when people say, you know, obviously the war on poverty failed because poverty is still high, again, a simple census chart. I've done some regression things that are a little more complicated than this, but basically nobody, when Peter and I and Hillary's father were all at IRP in the mid-70s and had been asked, what is the median earnings of men going to be 40 years from now, nobody would have said it's going to be the same thing. And that's basically it. So in my, you know, the whole story, why is poverty so high? It's because median earnings of male full-time, full-year workers stopped growing. This is obviously a group, if you work full-time year-round, you don't get unemployment insurance and you don't get welfare, so it's not the negative response to rising government benefits that people would say. And in some sense, this is the remarkable period. I don't know, Peter, is this, were there other previous periods in American history with this long a period of no median wage growth?
That makes the time, well, the 1930s is the closest.
But that was a decade.
No, I mean, a decade and a half at the start of the 20th century, but this is pretty outstanding, especially since it's immediately preceded, as you showed me, with
just a doubling. Right, right. So this, and in some sense, that's, if you listen to the politicians, the assumption underneath the view that we should never raise tax rates is that a rising tide still lifts all boats. I mean, it just, and it did from 47 to 73. It just hasn't from 73 to 2012. I'll just flip through this. People know this, so that's all men. This is by educational attainment, where the gains are for people with BAs and higher degrees. That's the same data. Household income by quintile. There's one in here. That's the official poverty rate. I'll go through this pretty quickly. But again, one of the things I've said when people talk about, oh, it's terrible under Obama, the poverty rate rose and it's 15%. There was actually a higher increase in poverty during the first Reagan. I couldn't get any reporters to report that I talked to this. When the poverty numbers came out, isn't it terrible after all the stimulus that Obama put in place? Unemployment is still, look how high unemployment is, and poverty is 15%. And I said, well, the recession in the 80s wasn't that severe, and it hit 15%. And if you actually look at the data, it went up more under the first Reagan administration. Again, this is well-known territory to economists. People argue over how much the various sources have to do with the high rates of poverty, stagnation of male median earnings and rising inequality, skill bias, technological changes, globalization, declining unionization, erosion of the minimum wage, declining progressivity of the income tax, the explosion of executive pay. It's all of the above, and people have their different choices, but the point is there really has been nothing going in the way of reducing inequality except the expansion of food stamps, the expansion of the earned income tax credit, which for historical reasons don't get counted in the official poverty rate, but clearly are progressive policies that have been put in place and have grown over the past years. Again, this is the same thing. If somebody said, well, what about after-tax income? You basically see the same kind of things. So whatever measure you use, you'll see a step ladder moving up. Oh, I know why I have this one, because of the top 1%. So the ones, in other words, even the top 20% haven't done that well relative to the top 1%. But again, and this is after tax, this is the CBO data, and so I think most people think these are the most reliable, carefully done, and I think they've also, I can't remember whether these also adjust for different persons. So it may. So that brings us to the Great Recession, and at the point at which obviously the Great Recession would be expected to raise poverty and inequality. The recession was deep. About 6% of all jobs were lost. I have, maybe it's the next chart that shows in the 80s, only 3% of the jobs were lost. So this was twice as severe, and partly why I say, oh, so poverty. If you had asked me in 2009, I would have thought poverty would have hit 17-18%, not 15% as a peak, because we lost so many jobs. It was accompanied by a labor market crisis, a financial crisis, and a housing market crisis. Yeah, this is from the Economic Policy Institute. But so this recession is twice as deep. 94%, we lost 6% of jobs, whereas in 81 we only lost 3%. But the point here is that in 81 the recovery was quick, so that by 24 months from the beginning of the recession you were back at the same level of jobs. Then in 2000 it was a very shallow recession. We never lost more than 2%, but it took 4 years to get back, and people talked about the 2000s as a jobless recovery. And before the recession, I think Paul Krugman was talking about the 2000s of being a lost decade, because median family income never recovered. When you sort of have the worst of both worlds here, you had a very deep loss and then a very slow recovery. Michael Greenstone and Adam Looney at Brookings put out projections, and I believe the last one I saw said that if we begin to create 200,000 jobs a month, which we haven't yet begun to do, but assuming we did, then then we would get back the same number of jobs 5 years from now, something like that. So nobody is predicting a very rapid recovery, which is part of the reason why I expect poverty and inequality to stay so high. So that brings me to some new data that I want to talk about that a group of us at the Poverty Center have been working on. And it's sort of, if there's a message from this, it's that the effects of the recession were even broader than one would think based on unemployment, but maybe not in California. And the reason I say this is, again, when I was talking to Marianne and Ann, I was saying about how few of the people in our sample, you'll see that in a minute, weren't affected by the recession. So I said, you know, we give people these calendars and we ask them in every month from January 07, we interviewed people twice. So you sort of get a two-year calendar in 09 and then another two-year calendar in 11. And if you asked me what I was doing every month, I would just take the line from employed and draw it across the 48 months. That's pretty quick to do. Lots of people obviously have to think, let's see, I was laid off in this month, then I got my job back, then I was laid off. And I said, it's remarkable how few people just had that employment across the top. And then I realized that in our data, Davis faculty don't show up in that category because there's also furlough, wage cut, etc. And so all the California faculty are in this group. No unemployment, but still affected. So maybe people in California wouldn't be as surprised when we show the extent of these effects. This study sort of had its intellectual background in a welfare reform panel that a group of us did from 97 to 2003, where we followed a panel of welfare recipients, and sort of our niche was that we, by definition, weren't going to be as big as the PSID or the NLSY or the SIP, but that we had this very broad range of questions. sort of think of it as the health data sets have great data on health and mental health, but really bad data on jobs and economics. The Federal Reserve Board does a really good job on assets, but they don't get anything on health and mental health. And we would try to get, with this multidisciplinary team, lots of information so you have the kinds of data we have. And we're just beginning, so we now have panel data, interviews in 2009 and 2011, and these calendars that go from 07 to 11 on the employment side. So we have this broad range, and looking at this broad range, in some ways I was surprised at the extent of the hardships. I'll show you. This is not the city of Detroit. It's the three-county Detroit metro area, so it includes the wealthy suburbs as well. In fact, the median income of the sample is relatively high. 41% of all respondents were unemployed in at least 1 month. And again, this is in my optimistic days in the depths of the recession, as lots of people I knew who lost jobs through no fault of their own, I thought, oh, this will lead, like the Depression led to this perception that people who are unemployed aren't lazy, and they weren't laid off because of their own incompetence. So it'll change our perceptions of the unemployed. And I haven't seen that lasting very long either. About 38% were employed in all months. 23% were behind on rent, mortgage, or in foreclosure. 13% had been evicted, homeless, or moved in with others. This is a random sample of people 19 to 64. These are very deep. Now, the recession in Michigan and in Detroit was deeper than it was elsewhere. I think I have it here, but if I don't, as I recall, the unemployment rate in Michigan hit 15% when it was 10% at the peak in the U.S. So not everybody in the country suffered as much, but certainly there were places that were as hard hit. Oh, there it is. So this is... This is our sample. So this is the monthly unemployment rate, and you can see, I was talking to one of your doctoral students today who's interested in young adults. The young adult unemployment rate in January 07 was already higher, but youth disproportionately bore the brunt. The other thing you see is that there is... not surprising, by March 2011, when we were in the field, I think the national unemployment rate was 9% then. For mature adults, which in this sample is 35 to 54, the unemployment rate was still 12%. No, that's mature adults is 55 and older. The prime age rate is 35 to 54. The youth rate still. So there was very little recovery. We're I think we now have the money to go in 2013, and we'll see the extent to which some of these hardships have gone away. These are the residents' experience at least 12 months of unemployment, which is our measure of long-term unemployment. I guess the point I would make is even 9% of the people who have a BA had a spell of 12 months of unemployment or more. Obviously, in any data set, you will see large black, non-black differences, large BA, no BA, and large blue-collar, white-collar. But certainly the extent of long-term unemployment was widely distributed. Long-term unemployment is clearly associated with these hardships, but again, I was surprised at the extent of problems. So the blue bars are people who had no unemployment. Now that could be they were not in the labor force, they were retired, they were disabled. This is not the data for people who worked in every month, but again, the blue bars are pretty high, 24% food insecurity, this is the standard USDA measure, 20% a housing problem, I'll tell you in a minute what the financial problems are, foregone medical care. It's always the case that the long-term unemployed have more of it, but again, I was struck by how broad the hardships are. The same thing with health and mental health. The red bars are people with no unemployment, but people talk to you that in the survey. These are in-home interviews, and it's a survey of about an hour, but there's also some opportunity for people to say things that get written down by the interviewer. So you get quite a lot of depression, anxiety, and fair or poor health in the no unemployment group, although again, these are much higher for people who've been long-term unemployed. This is hard to see, but this is so the Davis faculty are here, any employment problem, but no unemployment, because employment problems include layoff, wage reductions, and furloughs. And again, you can see no employment problems since January 07. This is only 26% of the population who basically would have drawn, as I would have, a line across employed. And even groups like people with a BA, while they're much more likely, have significance. This is the people who were both unemployed at the second wave and had 12 months of unemployment since 2007. The way this is done, some people could have had 12 months unemployed since January 07, but were employed in 2001, and that's why that previous figure had more unemployment. I'm happy to take questions. Everybody's so quiet. Yeah, Anne.
Did you guys collect anything on the income changes for these long-term unemployed people? I haven't actually seen anything reported on.
We have detailed information. I have something coming up on transfer receipt.
Yeah.
And part of this is, as you can imagine, cleaning these data sets is very complicated. Yeah. And so we rushed out. There's a few analytics in here, but mostly descriptive. But we do know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a paper on the people who were below the poverty line, the extent to which they got public and private transfers, and we have the extent to which people get UI. I'll get to some of that. So we have all of that. What we don't have, in retrospect, I'm not sure we could have figured out how to do it. We don't really have good data on consumption. So, people would say things like, the reason I avoided foreclosure is because I spent down my kids, I'd been saving for my kids' education, and I spent that down, and we avoided foreclosure. And we will observe a decline in assets, but the way we have the assets is we can't determine whether the decline in assets was due to their having lost value in the stock market or having spent down. The only thing we explicitly have, and we'll have a paper on this, are people who withdrew from their retirement accounts. We explicitly asked, did you stop putting in, did you take out? And there, again, this is the the likelihood of various dimensions of inequality continuing. In 2009, with the Dow at 6,000, certainly everybody I knew was making jokes about 401ks being 201ks. But by 2011, there's increased inequality in assets because people who were laid off cashed out at the bottom to maintain consumption. So there was big inequality in assets in 2009, and it's increased by 2011 because, so if you're a faculty member and every month you're working, the TAA contributions are going in, and then the market goes back up. No faculty are making jokes about 201Ks because it's probably, what, 385Ks now, that maybe 15% lower than it was, whatever. But, and so in the PSID data, which I don't have here, but we've looked at the PSID wealth data, the Gini coefficient of wealth inequality has continued to grow over this period. And I think the long-run implications might be that you would really expect that to grow even faster than income inequality, because people more quickly, you know, as the unemployment rate falls to 6%, the earnings inequality will begin to fall much more rapidly than the wealth inequality. So we do have that, but I don't have a lot of that here. I'm going to skip over this, but just I want to remember what the financial problems we have are: being behind on utility bills, recently using a payday loan, recently having a credit card canceled, and recently going through bankruptcy. So these are not minor financial problems. The housing problems, behind on rent, behind on mortgage, move for cost, move in with others to share expenses, evicted recently, and experienced homeless recently. And these usually mean in the last 12 months. And this may be hard to see, but again, what struck me is, so 32% of a random sample had one of these housing problems, which are pretty severe. 10% had them in both years. Food insecurity, I kept saying, are we sure this is right? It just seemed too high for me. But everybody says they've benchmarked it with the CPS. This is not hunger, which is much smaller. But, you know, roughly 30% show up as food insecure in this USDA measure. And this is, did you not go to a doctor or a dentist because you couldn't afford to do so? You know, and that's a quarter of the people in the two surveys. So these are, you know, pretty extensive levels of hardship. This gets a little close to what Ann was talking about, because we have looked at detailed benefits. I guess the conventional wisdom about the safety net, the good news here is most people who are below 200% of the federal poverty line are getting at least some benefits. Private charity is really trivial, in part because the charities begin to suffer at the same time that need increases. I mean, as an example, when I say people laid off through no fault of their own, I had a niece working in New York at the Lower East Side Museum. 90% of their donors, who usually made annual contributions at the end of the year, had their money with Bernard Madoff. Needless to say, most of the staff there were laid off. I mean, and so that's the extreme example of why the recession response to charity is going to be as low. But again, I think there's always this, it would be much better if people didn't have to pay taxes and were able to give money through private charity. But the benefit, at least the self-reported receipt of food or shelter assistance, as you'll see, is quite low. So, yeah.
It's hard to tell from this study, though, to what extent this is about the problems of Detroit, the Detroit area as a mature manufacturing center, to what extent a lot of these problems people would have even before the recession came. So do you have any idea about how you would establish some kind of baseline?
Yeah, and that's so basically what we're starting to do is to look at things like people who had no unemployment spell prior to wave one, what kinds of changes. So we're literally, this is data that a bunch of people rushed to get some descriptive papers ready for the APAM meeting, which was earlier in November. So that's exactly right. But we do have people who had no recent history of unemployment getting laid off and what happens to them, and then we also have people coming back. So at this point, this is very descriptive, and I'm not making any causal statement. You would expect the changes to be bigger in this area because the hits were better, but in a small sample that actually makes it better, because if you couldn't do a study like this in an area that went from, I don't know, 4 to 8% unemployment, you just wouldn't have as many people.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.